This is episode 61 of the Fifth Estate podcast. Jeff Blair on elections, politics, and music.
Hey there, folks. Neil Doing here to talk to you about our friends at Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And they do this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. It's very affordable. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. One of the things I most appreciate about it is that it's very easy. It comes with an instruction card, easy to follow, and you can prepare your meal in about 40 minutes, give or take. It works great. Some of their upcoming meals: basil pesto chicken with summer vegetable panzanella, sauteed shrimp and green beans with globe tomatoes, spinach, and orzo pasta, whole grain pasta and summer vegetables with heirloom tomato caprese salad, miso butter salmon and lo mein noodles with cucumber and charmed tomatoes, and meatball pizza with fresh mozzarella cheese and charmed tomatoes. They're really liking those charmed tomatoes this month. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/fifth. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/fifth.
All right, it's time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
Jay, I'm doing all right. I just came off of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Friends, which is a right-wing video webcast that airs live every Thursday at 9 o'clock. And,
never heard of it.
Yeah, I know. It's a fine show. It's a fine show. It's full of many fine people. And
don't know it.
Somebody followed you home.
Indeed. Our old friend Jeff Blair, who is a co-host on BATF with me, is joining us for this episode of The Fifth Estate. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, since he like broke in before he's supposed to, because the first thing that we do is we tell all of our wonderful listeners to go out and subscribe to this podcast, to leave ratings, to leave reviews. Tell us how wonderful we are.
Yes, we do. We prefer 5-star reviews, and we insist that you grant them to us. And I think that our guest Jeff will join me in calling for 5-star reviews when he tweets out this link to the show.
Yes, that is right. Jeff Blair.
I can't in good conscience call for a 5-star review of any show that I appear on.
The variation of the old Groucho Marx. I don't want to be a member of a club that would have somebody like me. I don't want to belong to a club that would have somebody like me as a member. Is that it?
That's right. Well, for those who are recent followers to the Fifth Estate show, and maybe haven't heard haven't heard Jeff on with us before, this is our first three-time guest.
Of course, Jeff, the first episode,
but of course, you know. Fourth episode, but one was lost to history, sadly. But
this is the fourth.
Yeah, because Jeff did the one with language, and for some reason it just got
But then he was on again. He wasn't on again since that. This would be
no. I've been on. No, Neil is correct. This will be my third appearance, and there would be four if we had not lost the best appearance I ever did, which was the long forgotten and memory hold linguistics podcast.
Yes, the linguistics podcast,
which was actually a fantastic episode. I'm not going to lie to you. It sounds like a dry subject, but we made it good.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, of course, going back in history, you know, we did a podcast with Jeff before this one. It's called Splintered Caucus, and we wrapped that up, I think, in January of 2016, and then we started Fifth Estate in April of that year. And so we like to have Jeff on, just, you know, get the band back together a little bit. We need to have Amy back on at some point too. But yep. But Jeff, welcome back, my friend.
Well, as always, it is my pleasure to be here. And for those who are also unaware, the other hat that I wear, other than being an attorney who seeks to keep his normal work life anonymous, is as an elections analyst for the Decision Desk HQ, which, if you aren't aware, what the Decision Desk HQ does is we do a lot of race calling. We do a lot of we do exit polls now these days for important and contested races. We do elections analysis, historical analysis, and we actually just recently signed a long-term contract with BuzzFeed, and we may be signing contracts with some other companies in the future to do their race projections on election night for the foreseeable future, for the 2018 cycle for sure, and we'll see what happens going forward. A lot of really big things, good things are happening for the Decision Desk. That was, of course, founded and is run by Brandon Finnegan, who I think you guys have had Brandon on at least once, right? Or am I wrong about that?
I'm not sure we've had Brandon. We've had Andrea, we've had you. But yeah, mate, congratulations. You guys have done really great work. And just to remind everybody out there, Decision Desk, I think, was the first to call the 2016 election for Trump, right? You guys,
yes.
We were in the saw it happening.
We were at BuzzFeed headquarters. Andrea and me and Varad Mehta and Brandon were all there. We were doing the live cast, and it was a rather amazing experience and rather unexpected, of course, given what we had all thought would happen going in, to see it happen in real time. And, well, boy, it's been an amazing 7 months since then, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has. And that kind of leads us into our topic of, you know, the future. You know, what is coming down the pike here from an election standpoint. And I wanted to start the ball here rolling with Alabama. They had special election, right?
Primary? Right?
Yes, a special election for the Senate primary. It was both parties, of course, held primaries for this, but the one where the real excitement, the real action is, was on the Republican side.
Mm-hmm. And so who were the contenders in this special election?
Okay, so first of all, the background is that the Alabama Senate seat came open when Jeff Sessions was confirmed as Attorney General, which is, of course, ironic because we seem to think that Jeff Sessions' continuing role as Attorney General might be hanging on by a thread, and it would be deeply, deeply ironic if he gave up a lifelong appointment to the Senate to serve for a mere 8 months or so as Trump's Attorney General. But given that he was confirmed and he's now serving in the Trump administration, what is essentially seen to be a pretty safe Republican seat came open. And when those safe Republican seats come open, usually in the Deep South, what you get is a real free-for-all in terms of everybody throwing their hat into the ring because, as I said, it's more or less a lifetime sinecure, minus some incredible scandal or some incredible national wave, which, you know, I can see some dark waves forming out in the ocean hitting land in 2018 for the Republican Party, but I think the Alabama seat is going to remain fairly secure no matter what happens. In this case, you had three candidates that were running, three major candidates. Of course, there were like 16 people who threw their hat in the ring, but of course, most of them were just, you know, it was the rent is too high guy, basically. And the three ones that mattered were Luther Strange, who was the appointed sitting senator for Alabama, and he's the one who's currently there in Washington, D.C., versus Roy Moore, Judge Roy Moore, although you can't really call him Judge Roy Moore because he was twice elected Supreme Court Justice for the Chief Justice, rather, of the Alabama Supreme Court, and he was twice removed from that position for failure to enforce the law. No joke. And then the third one, who's now irrelevant, although kind of maybe irrelevant in terms of who his support goes to, was Congressman Mo Brooks, who was from Alabama's 5th District. That's the northern part of the district, the northern part of the state, mostly bordering Tennessee. He came in third place with only 20% of the vote on Tuesday. He was eliminated. This is the South. The South's primaries generally go by a top two format, so that if nobody gets above 50% in the first round, you go to a runoff with the two highest remaining survivors. On the Democratic side, Doug Jones, who's the Democratic candidate, and I still even now contend basically their sacrificial lamb, won 60-something percent of the vote. He doesn't have to face a runoff. Yeah. On the Republican side, however, the incumbent, a guy named Luther Strange, as I said, with a very interesting backstory that explains the reason this is interesting is that the dynamic between Luther Strange, who is the incumbent appointed senator, and Roy Moore, the sort of crazy religious conservative kind of running as a Trumpier than thou fella, is an interesting a petri dish or perhaps a crucible for the post-Trump era, showing how these dynamics are playing out, especially in the ultra-red states.
Yeah.
Roy Moore finished significantly ahead of Strange in the runoff. So Roy Moore got about 39% of the vote. Strange got 32% of the vote. So it's a pretty solid 7% victory. And then Mo Brooks got 20% of the vote, but Brooks kind of ran as a Trumpier than thou guy. Right. You gotta wonder where this support is gonna go, where it's not gonna go. But there are a lot of other factors in play here.
If you could handicap them pretty quickly, like, so Luther Strange is he generic Republican? Roy Moore, as you said, is the Trumpy guy. And where did Mo Brooks fit in? What is his kind of position in that?
Brooks tried to run as the Trumpy guy.
Super Trumpy guy, because
it's also complicated, especially, you know, people who look at it from outside the state always shake their heads at people who live inside the state, rather, shake their heads at people outside the state who don't understand there's real subtle dynamics going on here. Luther Strange might be the sort of establishment GOP guy, Mitch McConnell's guy. He is. McConnell likes him. Put a lot of money from the NRS seats, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, into supporting Strange. But there are interesting other factors that are in play here. One of them is the fact that Donald Trump endorsed Strange, and I assume is going to continue to endorse Strange. Strange is a reliable vote. This is important. He's not a troublemaker. He's not a guy who calls attention to himself. He's just a check-the-box sort of whatever is coming through the pass that the president wants me to vote on. Yes, I'm going to vote yes on it. That's the kind of guy that Trump actually needs to have as his corner, as opposed to Roy Moore, who is running as a very kind of Trump-esque sort of a figure, but has his own independent brand and has since literally the early 2000s. This is the thing about Roy Moore. He's had not only a second act in his career, but a third act. He was first elected to the Supreme Court as Chief Justice. Alabama has judicial elections. Some states do appointments. Some states have races. Alabama has races for it. The first time he was elected as Chief Justice, he got removed from the court for this rather famous, for our older listeners, Ten Commandments kerfuffle.
Where I remember insisted, that.
Right. He insisted on posting the Ten Commandments outside the Supreme Court's room, their chambers, in violation of the law, and then when told he had to back down, refused to do it on principle and was removed from the Supreme Court. Kind of became a mainstream media laughing stock for it. But he had the last laugh because in 2012, when Obama was winning re-election, mind you, he ran again for Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice, and he won again. And he was removed from the court again, this time for announcing that he would not allow Obergefell, Supreme Court decision instantiating gay marriage as the law of the land, to be enforced in the state of Alabama. So he was removed from the court the second time and again became a laughingstock a second time, especially among the mainstream media. through all those things, he's built up a unique brand that he has. He's the classic example of what they call a high floor, low ceiling candidate. He has a very committed base that loves him. Usually, you know, you would call them sort of religious Southern Baptist conservative types, cultural conservatives who just love him, will vote for him. But there are a lot of other people, and not just Democrats, but including Republicans, especially on the southern, you know, Birmingham and Mobile, who don't really want anything to do with Moore, kind of find him to be an embarrassment to the state, an embarrassment to the Republican Party. The question is that even though Moore finished with about 38% of the vote, can he get much higher than that in a runoff? Now, strange, given the fact that he has Trump's endorsement, you think, okay, well, you know, he can top that. He can do better than that. He may have a chance of beating out Roy Moore, especially given that Moore has these anchors around his ankles. But the problem is that Luther Strange has his own problems, the most important of which is the fact that he was appointed by a governor who is now an ex-governor who's probably less popular in the state of Alabama than herpes and chlamydia combined. The guy's name is Robert Bentley. He was scandal-tarred for years before he finally resigned in the spring of 2017. And there's a wide-ranging belief in the state that Luther Strange, who was the attorney general of Alabama before he was appointed to the Senate seat, slow-rolled the investigation into Bentley in order to sort of gain chits with him so he could get that Senate appointment.
So
kind of
from
a corrupt bargain. And that is playing against him.
So from like a potential Trump supporter's perspective, would Strange be like a creature of the quote unquote swamp?
Honestly, I think Trump supporters will go where Trump goes. It all depends, in my opinion, on what Trump does. If Trump, and I think this is quite possible, Trump is obviously, as we may discuss a little later on today, facing some pretty tough headlines nationally speaking, right? Getting a lot of flack. Well, what does Trump like to do when he's taking a lot of flack from the national media and everybody is out there saying what a terrible president he is? He's reading all these polling numbers showing approval rating. He likes to go hold a rally where he sits with his biggest fans and says things that he soaks up the applause. The best possible place to do that would be in a state like Alabama. So I think it's quite possible you could see somebody convincing Trump to say, hey, why don't you go down to Alabama, hold a rally for Luther Strange, soak up the love, soak up the applause, and that will please Trump because he likes to feel good about himself. Everybody does, but Trump more so than most. And I think it would also help Luther Strange because I think a lot of Trump's fans will go where he tells them to go. It's a tribalistic thing. I don't know if it's enough to put Strange over the top. The sort of, if you had to call it beyond the veil of ignorance, you would say that Roy Moore is the odds-on favorite to win this runoff. But stranger things have happened because, of course, in 2014, there was the Thad Cochran, Chris McDaniel runoff in Mississippi, right next door, where McDaniel finished ahead of Cochran, and everybody thought Cochran was toast. But Cochran ended up winning the primary.
Right, but now how does Trump play into this? Because he has endorsed Strange. And so, you know, are people going to reject Trump and reject him endorsing the establishment candidate and go with Moore?
No.
Or are they going to drift back to Strange once the general starts the runoff?
I mean, listen, Jay, I've been wrong before and God knows I will be wrong again. In fact, I could be wrong very soon. But I tend to believe that the Trump's fans, especially in the Deep South where they're already tribal Republicans, they're not like in the North and the Midwest, or, you know, Democrats who crossed over for this election. Those guys are going to follow where he leads. If he comes out there and he gives a real full-throated endorsement to Luther Strange, says, I need this man in the Senate, I need you to send him here, I need you to come out for him, that's going to move votes. And they're not going to say, oh, well, he's betraying us. They're going to say, well, he knows better than us. You know, all the stuff about drain the swamp rhetoric, people are capable, regardless of what you or I might think about what the reality here is or what the truth is. They're not going to say, well, but Strange is kind of like a Mitch McConnell-approved establishment Republican, which is true. They're going to say, well, Donald Trump tells me that this is my man, so he's my man. I think there are very few places where Trump's full-throated endorsement can actually sway an election. I think Alabama is one of them. So it will be fascinating to see what he does here.
What about Arizona?
Oh, geez, boy. I mean, listen, I think Arizona, people always talk about how Dean Heller is the most threatened senator in the 2018 cycle that's coming up. And they're right, I think, because obviously Nevada voted for Hillary Clinton, although it didn't vote for Hillary by that much. But I think Jeff Flake is equally as threatened. And it isn't because Arizona is a blue state, although it's trending more and more in that direction each passing cycle. It's because Flake is so hugely unpopular with his own base. And it pains me to say so. I mean, just speaking not as an analyst, but, you know, just in terms of my own political opinions, I like Jeff Flake. I think he's a pretty principled guy. The stances that he has taken are ones that I would take myself and I agree with, but there's just no denying the fact that it is not playing well among the Republican base in that state.
Well, do you think he loses the primary, or is he going to lose the general because of his a weak base?
I think if he wins the general, if he wins the primary, he still wins the general because at the end of the day,
so you think he's actually going to lose to Kelly Ward? Then
voters ultimately ask themselves the question: do I want to send a guy to Washington, D.C. to caucus with Chuck Schumer and the Democrats or with, you know, the Republicans and Mitch McConnell? And nobody likes Mitch McConnell, but it's still Trump's team or Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's team. And ultimately, I think enough people probably would bite the bullet. And Flake does get crossover support, so there are Democrats who will vote for him too. If you put Kelly Ward, who's like one of the people running against Flake, she's a bit of a crackpot, kind of you know, not exactly a top-tier candidate, kind of a Sharon Angle,
Sharon Angle, right.
If you remember the candidate who ran against Harry Reid in 2010 in Nevada, she's kind of a Sharon Angle type. And if you put her, boy, that seat is really threatened. That is for the first time I could see a Democrat being elected to the Senate seat in Arizona in God knows how long. Those two seats have been Republican for a very, very long time. And I think that if Flake gets bounced in the primary, which I think is the real threat and very possible, then you could see the seat going Democratic because Flake will get crossed where the incumbent party is always at a disadvantage, and in a state that is trending increasingly Democratic, you got a lot of wheels in play there that are curving away from the Republicans. So it is those two races, Nevada and Arizona, are the ones where the Republicans are most at risk.
But let's turn our attention nationwide here and talk about the Democrats. Sort of emerging electoral strategy going into 2018 and then into 2020. I know it's very, very, very early after their astonishing defeat in 2016 to really identify trends. But do you see any trends that are sort of germinating? Do you see them testing out any ideas about trying to see what sticks, or are they kind of flailing?
Oh, sorry. Pardon me. I you have to excuse me. I was watching highlights of my appearance on BATF. I what was it you said?
Oh, Jeff.
I'm just kidding. I actually was, but I do know the point you're making. And here is the thing. This is the thing that every sensible, sane analyst will say to you as well, is that it is August 15th. Well, it's 17th now, but it's midway through August of 2017. You know, what's the old nostrum that, like, you know, 2 months is 7 lifetimes in politics? Well, we have, you know, 100 left at this point between now and November of 2018. That said, it's very clear that certain trends are sort of always in play. The one that's the most obvious is the midterm party always gets walloped the party that is out of power in executive government always gets walloped during the midterms. There's only been 2 times in recent history where that has not happened. One of them was in 2002, where George Bush and the Republicans made significant gains in the House and Senate. And I think we all know the reason why that was. It was pretty much the singular definition of a once-in-a-lifetime event. And the other one was in 1998, another fairly unique circumstance, where the Republicans had just impeached Bill Clinton. And it was such a surprising and unexpected outcome. The Republicans very much expected to gain in 1998 that it cost Newt Gingrich's job. He had to resign as Speaker of the House. He had to resign his seat in Congress after that. So all other things being held equal, the Democrats should make gains certainly in the House. There are a lot of threatened seats there. In the Senate, it's a very different story simply because the map is so brutally bad for them. We just talked about the two seats where Republicans are threatened, which are Arizona and Nevada. Well, we spent a lot of time talking about that, but what we haven't talked about is the literally 10 to 12 seats the Democrats have to defend that went for states that voted for Trump, and some of which voted for Trump by double digits. North Dakota, Heidi Heitkamp, Missouri with Claire McCaskill, Montana with John Tester, Indiana with Joe Donnelly. And, you know, there are swing states like Pennsylvania with Bob Casey and Florida with Bill Nelson. There are so many spots on the map where the the Democrats have to play defense here that in a world where Hillary Clinton had won the presidential race, I could have very reasonably forecasted a Republican gain of 10 to 12 seats in 2018. As it is, because of Trump's unpopularity, I'm thinking they'll probably do good to only gain one or two, but I would be surprised if they actually ended up losing anything. So the Democrats right now, I think the strategy they're trying to pursue, and this is probably the only sensible thing that they are doing, that they can do, is a base mobilization strategy. What happened in 2016? The base, well, they came out, certainly the white educated classes, but African Americans and minorities did not come out for Hillary Clinton the way they came out for Barack Obama. I think, you know, Neil, you and I, just a couple of minutes ago on BATF, we discussed, well, why is it that Democrats are focusing on, like, removing statues from the Capitol of Confederate generals when they could focus on, which is a divisive issue that, you know, there are people, you know, especially in the South who would disagree with, and even in the North, versus, you know, just focusing on Richard Spencer and neo-Nazis and the fact that Trump embraced neo-Nazis, which is an easy layup and everybody can agree with. And I think the reason for that is that they feel the need to mobilize minorities who did not show up in 2016 to vote in the sorts of numbers that they were supposed to. But they are terrified of losing what they expect to be a good midterm cycle, given Trump's unpopularity, if African Americans and Hispanics do not show up to vote. So they're going to go for any kind of tactics that allow them to gin up the anger and sort of the outrage of those sorts of voters. It makes sense. As we speak now, it's hard to say. If we held the election today, yeah, it could be a bloodbath for the Republican Party. But 35% now, who knows? Who's to say whether Trump's approval rating will be in the 35s? What if there's a, you know, Lord only knows. What if there's a nuclear exchange in North Korea? What if there's some sort of, you know, foreign policy crisis? There's just so many X factors that can pop up between now and November of 2018 that it makes it hard to predict. But if you hold all things equal, yeah, it's the House is in play for the Democrats. I think it is incredibly plausible that they would pick up the 25 or so seats they need to retake control of the House. The Senate, I would be very surprised if they took control of the Senate because the math is just that brutal for them. Crickets. You sons of bitches.
That's not really going in.
No, you should. No, you seriously, leave it in. I don't mind.
It might actually be kind of funny. No,
it would. I'm totally up for
no,
it.
No, the problem was that I kind of lost the
like a lengthy monologue. You know, it's like always like people just rolling their eyes back into their heads.
All right, so before we get into something else, let's ask you this question. And this we posed this one actually, and we had former speechwriter for Barack Obama, John Favreau, on the show a couple of weeks ago.
I remember, I listened.
We asked him if there are areas where, you know, can the left and the right, not even so much forget about policy ideas and forget about, you know, even agreeing, but let's say, can the left and the right, are we at a point where the left and the right can no longer even have a productive conversation? Forget about a debate about policy. We're just talking about conversing, talking to each other about issues. Are we beyond that, or do you still think is there a little glimmer of hope?
I'm going to bet that John tried to give you the optimistic answer. So here I am bringing you a message of unholy despair and doom. I am afraid that more and more, the answer to that question is no. Now, when I say the left and the right, I'm not talking about the quote-unquote elite left and right. And, you know, none of us are elite, least of all Neil. But what I mean is that we are kind of, we discuss politics, not for a living, always, some of us, but we're engaged. We reach out to people. We discuss things with people on Twitter. We do shows. We read every basically thing that comes across the transom. We know what it's about. We are not the average person who's a consumer on the one hand of, say, Fox News, on the other hand of, say, MSNBC or Daily Coast or something like that. I really am coming to a depressing conclusion, and this is my sort of doom and gloom Spenglerian decline theory in play, which is very much at odds with the fact that I do a lot of, you know, elections calling, you know, in my other spare time. But I feel like we're kind of turning into rather, you know, mindless tribalism. And I think actually the response from Trump about this horrible, this atrocity in Charlottesville is perfect evidence of that. I think he's playing to a sort of naked tribalism among his base. Now, his base isn't huge. It's not enough to say it's a true 50-50 proposition. But, you know, I see a future where the dialogue is increasingly controlled by the extremist elements on both ends, with the middle being squeezed out in the dialogue. There's a great song by a post-punk band called Magazine, which maybe all of your cool listeners will have heard of. It's great. It's called Shot by Both Sides. And it perfectly encapsulates what I feel like in this present political moment. You know, shot by both sides, they must have come to a secret understanding. I wormed my way into the heart of the crowd. I was shocked to find what was allowed. It's that sense that the radicals on both sides are the ones guiding the conversation, and everybody is going to sort of gravitate towards a tribe, one side or another. And that renders reason to debate impossible. And it's easy for us to forget about that when we sit here. You know, you have guests from the left and the right. You had Jon Favreau on, for God's sakes. You know, you have, you know, people who are, you know, very conservative on too. It's not a big deal. But we aren't the kinds of people who listen to Alex Jones or go angrily, you know, type things on Think Progress or Huffington Post. And I think
Or run down people in cars.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was thinking of that in the Alex Jones side. Right, exactly. Oh. You know, well, yeah, but I think that whole conspiracy right-wing cluster is sort of indirectly the genesis of what we saw in Charlottesville, to be perfectly honest.
No, I agree. But let me ask you this, Jeff, though.
Yeah.
Because do you think that the tendency towards tribalism is something that people are inevitably going to get swept up in? Or do you think that the problem is that it falls to individuals to remember to be charitable and kind and to not dismiss people out of hand? I mean, I've had plenty of pleasant conversations with Trump supporters about Trump, where I've been able to voice criticisms of him in a respectful way.
Sure.
And they are able to articulate their position and criticize mine in a respectful way without,
sure,
you know, without anybody waving a Nazi flag or putting on a black mask and smashing a shop window. I mean, it can happen, and it takes individuals. Would you agree with that, or do you think that we're just like kind of powerless in the face of really motivated, like you said, fringe elements?
Well, it's not even just fringe elements. It's political activists. You have to ask yourself, how is political power wielded in America? It's wielded on essentially the level of especially in the face of our kind of ineffective and ineffectual legislative branch. It's basically the judiciary and the executive branch now. So people fight like mad dogs for the presidency, which has the power to appoint the judiciary, and for the judiciary itself. And those are the really, really smart people also understand that the administrative state plays a huge role. But that's, you know, a question for another day. These are the the forces that have the power to actually change the lives of day-to-day Americans. And so you're put in a position where, you know, having these conversations, these sort of person-to-person conversations, is valuable and helpful. Again, I'm giving you a counsel of despair, and I apologize for that. But I just see the forces of polarization in the present age, with the activist forces behind them that push towards these things, being so powerful and so difficult to resist. And by the way, this is not just something that you find on the left. Although, you know, I'm a conservative, so it's easy for me to stand there and easily see the flaws of the left. It's helpful, in fact, for me in a way, for the whole Trump thing to happen in 2016. It made it very easy for me to see the same forces operating on the right. I think it's a human condition, incidentally. It's not a political condition. But yes, I do see this progress towards tribalistic polarization being inevitable. And the primary reason for that is that we are kind of progressing into a culture where our laws and our nostrums and the way that we live our lives are going to be handed down by fiat, whether it's via a judiciary, an executive branch, or, and this is the primary resentment of conservatives, I would say particularly Trumpist conservatives, via culture, pop culture, telling us that these are the right things to believe, these are the wrong things to believe. And if you believe the wrong things, then you're a garbage person who doesn't deserve the respect of sensible and civilized men. Once you have those dynamics in play, it sort of, in my opinion, inevitably slowly dissolves into a Hobbesian state, bellum omnium contra omnes, war by all against all. And, you know, in the Hobbesian state, what people do is they coalesce into tribes. This is the American Republic. We are a two-party system. It's going to be very difficult for those of us who are in the center of that, not even in a sense of being a centrist, but just being uncommitted to the sort of tribal bloody-mindedness of the left and the right, to stay away from one side or another when they're the ones who guide the conversation and we are left adrift and powerless. At some point, I think there's a lot of people who will have a temptation to cast their lot with one side or the other, if only so they can have a say again in what happens. Now, I'm not going to fall prey to that temptation. Why? I mean, this is going to, again, sound silly, and I hope it doesn't sound preachy, but it's kind of my Christian ethics that keep me from falling into that. I ultimately don't care. I care deeply about politics. I care deeply about this world, but I also care deeply about sort of transcendental ethics, and it's never going to be shaken from me. So I'm left with a very pessimistic view of the present course that we're on, the hope that somehow we can deviate from it. But I'm not seeing, at least yet, particularly with Trump and in the White House and Bannon behind him kind of stirring the pot and, you know, sort of cynical operators on both sides, I don't see how we're deviating from it yet. And I'm sorry to have unexpectedly created the most depressing episode of the Fifth Estate podcast ever.
Yeah, I think our
last one was pretty depressing, actually. But that was okay. My fault.
Well...
I was drinking during the last episode you were on.
Ah, well, there you go.
I got maudlin.
Yeah. Well, this was pretty close. So let's move on to something a little bit more pleasant.
Yes, let's contemplate our eventual ends.
So no, we'll first of all we'll kind of chuckle at the idea that Charles Cook at National Review thinks that you actually have good taste in music or something like that, because he's offered you the opportunity. Tell us, we're going to let you now talk about a music podcast you're going to be doing.
Well, you know, at the risk of being premature, since we're supposed to tape our first episode tomorrow, kind of a preview. I'm going to be doing a new podcast with National Review. My co-host is going to be Scott Bertram, who's a radio host from Hillsdale in Michigan. And it's going to be called Political Beats. And basically what we want to do is create a safe space, if you will, where we don't talk about politics. Because God, as we have just demonstrated over the past 45 minutes, isn't politics so depressing? What we want to talk about is music. My true love, and as anybody familiar with this show who knows me knows what I spend almost half of my time doing, especially in these rather tumultuous days on Twitter, is talking about music. my real love. And so we're going to be...
I understand on Twitter, Jeff, that you... this is, I think, something you started doing after I left, thank God. But you have multi-hundred tweet discourses on music.
Yes, I like to go through various bands' discographies and explain what's good and bad about them and just sort of, I don't know, create a diversion from the world of things in politics and sort of petty sniping and tribalism. I truly believe there is something transcendent about music. I know you don't, Neil. I know that there's no poetry in your soul. I remember the last time I was here on the show, you confessed as much. You said that you just didn't like music. And
it's
that.
Background noise.
It's no. It's the music of the stars, my friend. It is the music of the stars. But anyways, the point of the show, and you know, we of course are gonna tape our first episode tomorrow, I believe. So we may mess with the format, but the idea is we want to have a guest on each week to talk about, and there'll be guests from the political space, whether it's politicians or operatives or journos or just people who do stuff like this. But we want to have them on not to talk about politics, but actually talk about the thing that they really love, which is their favorite band, their favorite artist, or maybe even an artist they really hate. You know, like one of the things that we've discussed is doing an episode on, like, the Eagles. Charlie Cook loves the Eagles. I hate the Eagles. And I don't hate them in a trendy, I saw the Big Lebowski way. I really, really loathe the Eagles. And yet I know so much about them because I know so much about so many acts that I dislike. Another one would be Billy Joel. There's lots of people who love Billy Joel. I am just not a fan. But I would love to talk
What?
To people. Yeah, exactly. See, there you go. See,
even I like Billy Joel.
No. Your proletarian tastes insult me, Neil. No. No, I'm kidding. They don't insult me, but they're wrong. The point is that's fun. That's fun to have people on who do this stuff for a living but actually would really prefer to debate whether, 52nd Street is a good album or it's a piece of flaming garbage because Scenes from an Italian Restaurant is a terrible song.
It's a great
album. Wow. Come on.
It's a good song.
I mean, Neil's not even from New York and he knows.
Billy Joel had one good album. It was Glass Houses. All right. And he was trying to be a rock and roll. You know what? I got to save my best stuff.
Yeah. Save your best stuff. Well,
seriously, though,
Jeff, is this like a fan show, super fan show? Is it for obsessives?
It depends. Any show that I'm on is going to have obsessive qualities because I'm obsessive about things. And that's just a fact. But we want to keep it on a level where people are going to be able to relate to it and understand and enjoy it, even if they aren't like super big fans of the artists that we're discussing that day. So like we're going to start with an artist format, but we might broaden it to be a more general thing like, great drummers or post-punk or stuff like that. But either way, it's going to be a cultural thing. It's not going to be just another stupid thing talking about who's up, who's down on the week, politics, this or that. It's going to be like, hey, Echo and the Bunnymen, really underrated post-punk band. That's a show I'd like to do. I want to do that show where I actually get to do my long-awaited Arcade Fire tweet storm in verbal form. All right, that's the kind of thing I'd like to do. And of course, it's interesting because we've given a lot of thought to like how we have to balance, like the acts that we talk about and the music that we talk about. Do we go with like the greatest hits, like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, stuff everyone's talked about, or do we go a little more obscure that has a much more selective audience, as Spinal Tap might say? I don't know. These are the things that you learn when you do a podcast, and you sort of learn them as you go. But I'm really looking forward to doing it, and it's just, as I said, it's a natural segue from what we were talking about earlier. It's a wonderful relief, a pressure valve from the way that politics right now especially can seem to be such a depressing sludge, trudge through the muck. And every day you wake up and there's just one more.
All right,
more,
all right, that's enough. You're going to depress everybody. You've already been depressing everybody. Stop.
Yeah, we already had the depressing.
Yeah, we already had the depressing part.
We're trying to end on a high note here.
No, this is the high note.
This is the high note.
No.
The great music that inspired us at all. And by the way, Genesis is a great band.
Okay. Now, as we start to wrap up, we have our final question, our gotcha question, which is right up your alley.
No, I don't even know what it is. I wasn't prepped in advance.
That's right. We never do prep anybody.
We never do prep anyone in advance for these questions, which is very important. Very important cultural question. In fact, it's probably could come up in your musical podcast, and it would be interesting to see what your co-host thinks. But Neil, go ahead. Tell him what we're gonna find out.
Jeff, this question before you, I agree with Jay. It will come up in your podcast eventually, and in fact, you hit upon it yourself earlier, perhaps by accident, or perhaps because. The question is, in fact, not terribly controversial, but the question, anyway, which is better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Wow.
Pick one.
Objectively or subjectively?
Gun to Doesn't your matter. Head, Just you, can, you can take, gun to your head, you're going to a deserted island, you can take one, not one album, but one collection with you, Beatles or Rolling Stones. So for the rest of your life, you're only going to listen to one of them.
Which one could you listen to longer before fashioning a rope from a coconut, a palm tree, and then hanging yourself?
Or cutting yourself and throwing yourself into the ocean, hoping the sharks take you.
Listen, you guys might or might not know that I wrote basically an entire internet book about the Rolling Stones. So I truly love them. I mean, I love them on a detailed, obsessive level. But yeah, the answer is the Beatles. The Beatles were objectively the greatest band of all time.
I'm sorry. I'm getting smoked on this one.
Well, here's the thing, because I think to myself, okay, you know what? You did it to me. You did it to me, Neil, when you told me you're going to the desert island, which is the band that you stick with before you fashion the coconut rope and the coconut noose. And it's the Beatles, because they have soaring melodies that I want to sing. Paul McCartney wrote Hey Jude. He wrote fucking Hey Jude, you know? I mean, like, what can you say? It's Hey Jude. They have You Never Give Me Your Money. They have Revolver and A Hard Day's Night. And the variety is so great. The breadth is so immense. And they were there first. They were there fustest with the bestest. I love the Stones. I think the Stones from 1964 to 1972 are one of the greatest bands that have ever walked on the face of this earth. But I got to go with the Beatles.
Well,
that was a great
there
choice.
There you have it.
All right. Well, hey, Jeff, thanks for being on.
Sure.
Really appreciate it. Always like having you here.
Follow me on @esotericcd on Twitter.
See that? Jeff doesn't even wait to ask to be where to follow. He wants you just go there and do it.
I've done it three times already.
Hey, wait.
Stay tuned, folks, for Political Beats. That's going to be at NRO, I presume, and perhaps iTunes and various other podcasting locales.
Yes, and we promise to compete directly head-to-head with the Fifth Estate.
You'll probably do fairly well.
Who knows?
Probably. All right. Jeff Blair, everyone. Esoteric CD on Twitter. And then what's the name of the podcast? What was it?
Political Beats.
Political
Until we change beats. It to something else. Who knows? But okay. We can start with that.
All right. Well, be sure to check that out. They're recording their first episode tomorrow. So look for it. If you follow Jeff, I'm sure once it's ready, he'll be tweeting it out like crazy. So you won't be able to miss it.
It'll probably be up next week, is my guess. I don't know for sure, being honest with you.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Thank you, Jeff. All right, Neil.
Yes, indeed, Jay.
Another one in the can. Yes. So that's pretty good. That's good. Had a good show.
Yes.
It was great.
Check.
I mean, if we're ready
I was waiting for you guys to read the ads. Where's your great announcer voice reading your sponsorship ads?
Oh, that comes in after you
just drop them in.
Yeah.
We pre-record those,
We've
Jeff.
Gotten lazy.
Darn.
Only the best for our sponsors.
Well, that's the thing. It's been too long since I've been on, because the last time I was on, the last two times I was on, you did them live.
Indeed. And we prefer to do them I think pre-recorded. That way, we figure
our
Dollar Shave
wanna...
Club and Blue Apron get the best quality. The best take.
Simply Safe.
How
Simply
do you...
Safe. Don't forget Simply Safe.
How do you guys get sponsors? I'm curious about how that works. By the way, I was asked, Charlie asked me when I agreed to this. He's like, you don't mind reading ads, do you? I'm like, hey. And I was actually literally thinking of the times I've been on with you guys or listened to the podcast or you read the ads. And I got to say, you know, Neil, you just have that great kind of half serious way of reading off the copy that makes it so fun. I'm like, okay, I can do it.
Well, we can talk a little bit more about the sponsors after we'll have to cut this part too.
I thought we were off the air.
We didn't say goodbye yet.
Yeah, Jay, go ahead and say goodbye.
Goodbye.